Last week, we began our month-long conversation on compassion by focusing inward, acknowledging that our first task in living a compassionate life is to be compassionate to ourselves. We learned some practices for self-love, including the loving kindness meditation. And as you'll recall, this practice and every other practice we went over involved breathing, breath. Ruha. Ruha is the Hebrew word used in the Old Testament for breath. It also refers to spirit, wind, and life itself. Ruha animates all of creation. It is the spirit of life, the source of all, the sacred, flowing through each and every living thing. It is the breath of God. Which is why breathing is so important to spirituality and well-being. Slowing down and breathing deeply and mindfully connects us with the sacred and grounds us in that which is bigger than the self, the spirit, the breath of life. But not everyone in America can breathe. The coronavirus, which impacts the respiratory system, is making its way across America and disproportionately affecting people of color. And just 3 weeks ago, another black man, George Floyd, was murdered in the streets of Minneapolis. The breath of life choked out of him by a Minneapolis police officer who knelt on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. His last words were, "I can't breathe. I can't breathe." Black Americans can't breathe in our society. The unrelenting knee of systemic racism is constantly on their neck. Let's start with coronavirus. African Americans, as I've said, are being infected and dying at much higher rates than whites. According to the COVID Racial Tracker, a joint project of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center, and the COVID Tracking Project. Nationally, African-American deaths from COVID-19 are nearly 2 times greater than would be expected based on their share of the population. In 4 states, the rate is 3 or more times greater. I looked up the statistics locally, and here in Iowa, African-Americans make up 4% of the population, 11% of coronavirus cases, and 5% of deaths. Nearby in Illinois, African Americans make up 27% of the population, 50% of coronavirus cases, and 47% of deaths. And in Wisconsin, African Americans make up 6% of the population, 21% of the coronavirus cases, and 25% of deaths. So why is this happening? Why is COVID-19 so disproportionately impacting Black Americans? Those of us in the field sadly expected this, says Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, director of the Equity Research and Innovation Center at Yale School of Medicine. We know that these racial ethnic disparities in COVID-19 are the result of pre-pandemic realities. It's a legacy of structural discrimination that has limited access to health and wealth for people of color, she says. Limited access to health and wealth. Limited access to health includes limited access to health care. Kamara Jones, physician and epidemiologist, explains African Americans are twice as likely to lack health insurance compared with their white counterparts, and more likely to live in medically underserved areas where primary care is sparse or expensive. So there's the lack of health insurance, limited access to care, and then when folks actually do receive medical treatment, the hospital in their neighborhood may not have the necessary supplies or equipment, and on top of all that, folks encounter racial bias, unconscious racial bias from their providers and medical institutions. Their pain is not taken seriously, They're not treated the same way as white people. The healthcare system is failing the black community all the way around, limiting access to health. Limited access to health also includes a limited access to a healthy environment in which to live. I started to really learn what this means when I was working in Boston at the UU Urban Ministry in Roxbury, Boston's historically black neighborhood. Walking around the streets of Roxbury, you can see the legacy of environmental racism all around you. There are the toxic waste sites where white business owners used to dump because they didn't have to live there and there were no consequences. There are the remnants of the old bus yard where buses used to idle all day and night, constantly clogging the neighborhood with exhaust fumes and contributing to high rates of asthma in that neighborhood. There are countless reminders of how environmental racism has played out for generations, contributing to the high rates of pre-existing conditions like asthma, obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes that make one more vulnerable to COVID-19. Environmental racism is a major contributor to coronavirus racial disparities. Jones says, what we need to do is uninvisibilize structural racism and say this structural racism and the historical federal partitioning of our cities into racially segregated neighborhoods, the disproportionate placement of toxic dump sites, the stuff which is giving us more asthma, more lung disease, or the HIV epidemic, these are the old aspects of racism showing up during this pandemic. None of this is new. Racism is a public health crisis and has been for a long time. Yes, coronavirus can impact anyone regardless of race. It has no boundaries, but if anything, this pandemic has made abundantly clear that the most significant pre-existing condition for coronavirus in America is racism. As it turns out, the determining factor in whether or not someone will be a victim of police brutality in America is also racism. Now, as a white person growing up in this country, I was taught from an early age that the police are friendly helpers, always there to protect me. And that has largely been my, albeit limited, experience with police. But for blacks growing up in America, the lesson is quite different. Avoid the police. If you do interact with them, do whatever they say, no sudden moves, keep your hands visible, explain everything you're doing, stay alive. Learning about this stark difference in how white and black communities experience policing and admitting the systemic nature of the problem has been a long, difficult process for me. For a long time, my brain didn't want to unlearn the lie that the police are unbiased, friendly helpers. In fact, 5 years ago or so, back in Boston in that historically black neighborhood of Roxbury, I heard a group of passionate black teenagers give a very well-informed presentation about the history of policing in America and call for the defunding of police. At the time, I could not hear what they were saying. It just sounded so far out there. The idea that it's not just a few bad apples, but the fact that the whole tree is poisoned went against everything I was taught. So I tuned it out. I conveniently ignored the truth and wrote it off as fringe radicalism. Defunding the police, that's just going too far, I said. I've been thinking a lot about these teenagers lately. I was especially reminded this week of the truth they told me all those years ago when I listened to a podcast called American Police on NPR's Throughline, featuring historian and author Khalil Gibran Muhammad. And all these years later, having had some time to process this information, I was finally able to hear the truth, and I have changed my mind about defunding the police. In the podcast, Khalil Gibran Muhammad explains that policing in America has always been brutal and was born out of a desire for white people to control black lives. In the early days of America, the first police were slave patrols, white citizens who took it upon themselves to violently enforce slave codes and keep black people enslaved. When slavery was abolished in 1865, the 13th Amendment made slavery illegal except as a punishment for a crime. So what did the southern states do? They passed black codes, making sure that just about everything a black person could do would be illegal and thereby keeping them subjugated. As a result, blacks basically couldn't do anything except for work for a white man on the white man's terms. Vigilante groups like the KKK took it upon themselves to ensure this by terrorizing black people. When the 14th and 15th Amendments passed, ensuring more equality for emancipated slaves, southern states simply adjusted their methods by developing Jim Crow laws. Meanwhile, in the North, as America was experiencing new waves of immigration in the 19th century and northern cities became more and more diverse, modern police forces were cropping up. These police forces largely served to enforce ethnic and racial hierarchies and act as foot soldiers for politicians. As the Great Migration occurred and blacks made their way to northern cities, as we head into the 20th century, these southern and northern policing models blended into something like what we have today. The first officially documented and investigated case of police brutality in America occurred in 1894. As Khalil Jabbar Muhammad says, less than two generations into modern policing, we have evidence of its fatal flaw. Black people have been persecuted and murdered by the police since the beginning of modern policing because the goal has always been to control black lives and protect whiteness. The death of George Floyd is another example of this horrific truth. In Minneapolis, where Floyd was murdered, the Minneapolis Police Force, which was founded in 1867, think about that, 1867, 2 years after emancipation, the Minneapolis Police Force uses violent force against people of color at the rate of 7 times that of whites. Just 20% of the population of Minneapolis is black, but according to the New York Times, when they get physical with kicks, neck holds, punches, shoves, takedowns, mace, tasers, or other forms of muscle, nearly 60% of that time, the person subject to the force is black. We have a real problem here. Police brutality against black and brown people is baked into the system. It is rooted in systemic racism and has been terrorizing black people and controlling their every move for centuries. The question before us now, says Jabbar Muhammad, is do white people in America still want police to protect their interests over the rights and dignities of the lives of black, brown, indigenous, and Asian populations in this country? Do we still want the police to enforce racism? I know a lot of people right now are asking questions about how could you possibly maintain public safety without police? But I invite you to consider this. Who kept George Floyd safe? Is it possible that it's not the police that are keeping you safe right now, but your whiteness? And if you're wondering why this issue has blown up all of a sudden and why people are so outraged in the streets, then you haven't been paying attention. People of color have not had the privilege or the luxury of tuning this issue out. They have been outraged and passionate and active and organizing for decades. I know it's easier to ignore the issue. I've been there very recently. It is much more comfortable to assume people of color are making this up or that it's just a couple of bad apples. Nothing that some good reform can't take care of. Now, I am thrilled that activists in Cedar Rapids are making progress with the city council right now on police reform. But I fear that reform isn't enough. Mesquite Noir of the Black Visions Collective in Minneapolis explains that Minneapolis has tried just about every reform people can come up with. It is the poster child of reform. Minneapolis currently has a black police chief. The Department of Justice under the Obama administration did a full review of the department. Officers now have body cameras. They have received implicit bias training. They have been trained not to put people in chokeholds. And yet, Noir says, still, the police department manages to murder black people in the streets. So black organizers and communities of color have been organizing for years, decades, to reduce the scope, scale, and power of the police. Most of us don't know about this work because organizations like the Black Visions Collective, Reclaim the Block, and the Movement for Black Lives don't get as much media attention as they should. But even though we, and again I'm speaking to white people today, even though we and the media haven't been paying attention, the people were organizing. Defunding the police is not a new idea, and it's not an impossible one. Other communities across the country, like Camden, New Jersey, and Eugene, Oregon, have been experimenting with alternatives to police for a while now, implementing more community-led safety efforts. And just this month, during the riots in Minneapolis, the community kept the city alive, organizing community patrols, food drives, ride-sharing, handing out PPE, and so much more. Defunding the police is not impossible, and it does not reduce public safety. It simply invites us to be creative and reimagine what public safety actually looks like for everyone. It requires us to be compassionate. Compassion is the heart's response to suffering. It's more than empathy. Compassion towards another is an action. So now that we're becoming more aware, if we weren't already, of the suffering of our black siblings due to systemic racism in our healthcare system and in our police model, what shall we do? How can we compassionately act? I can't answer that for you, but whatever you discover is yours to do, the time is now. And it might not be as complicated as you think. In an interview I heard this week, the Reverend Dr. William Barber said that our main job right now is to breathe, and keep going. Ruha cannot be stopped. The breath that was stolen from George Floyd, that's our breath now. The breath that has been stolen from so many black and brown people throughout the history of this nation, that too is our breath now. We must continue to breathe. To breathe life back into this world and reimagine a new, better, more just America. What a great opportunity. Beloveds, we have a real chance to change the world right now. Keep breathing, stay grounded, stay healthy, stay open, and let's get to work. The time is now. May this be so. Amen, and blessed be.